Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Part of the enduring appeal of Dutch paintings is their extraordinary naturalism, their ability to create semblance without being, as one 17th century art theorist wrote. Genre painters of the Dutch Golden Age have long been admired for just this ability, producing exquisite images of everyday life that, no matter how remote, feel like candid moments captured in time. The landmark exhibition, Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting, Inspiration and Rivalry, on view from October 22, 2017 through January 21, 2018, examined the artistic exchanges among Johannes Vermeer and his contemporaries from the mid-1650s to around 1680, when they reached the height of their technical ability and mastery of depictions of domestic life. In this lecture, delivered on November 12, 2017, Alexandra Libby explored how cultural events, scientific developments, and critical musings on time and temporality may have influenced these 17th century genre painters to create many of their most enduring, timeless works.
My name is Alexandra Libby, and I'm the assistant curator of Northern Baroque Paintings, which is the department that organized the current exhibition, Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting. And this lecture is part of a series of talks related to the show that explores aspects of the paintings by Vermeer and his contemporaries in an effort to come to terms with what makes them among the most memorable and enduring images of the Dutch Golden Age. For me, these elegant scenes of men and women writing letters, playing music, pining for loved ones, tending to their daily rituals, no matter how remote, feel both relevant and yet timeless. And the enduring appeal is owed in large part to their remarkable naturalism, their apparent truthfulness or fidelity to the world they represent, their ability to, as one 17th century Dutch art theorist wrote, create semblance without being. So with their sensitively rendered textures and fabrics and those nuanced glances and gestures, they invite us to lose ourselves in the worlds they picture, and of course we happily oblige. So there has been really no shortage of ink spilled over the question of naturalism in Dutch painting, largely the idea that it is paradoxically contrived, a convention. However, today I would like to think about it in terms of artists' increased awareness of temporality, that is to say, the state of existing within or having some relationship to time. Over the course of the 17th century, Dutch artists produced images that reflected a growing consciousness of time. Flower still lives developed from these very tidy static bouquets in full bloom to dynamic assortments of blossoms showing flowers budding, blooming, withering, conveying notions of transience and mortality. You have laid table pieces transformed from very neatly displayed foodstuffs to vibrant, messy scenes of partially eaten pies, overturned wine glasses, indicating the passage of time. Even in land and seascape paintings, they begin to show this greater attention to animation with wind rustling leaves or sweeping across the water, shadows stretch across grassy pastures, clouds drift across the sky, all suggesting the temporal specificity of a certain time of day or season or a weather pattern. And in genre painting, scenes of so-called everyday life, we see the same evolution from fanciful, idealized narratives to scenes of music, writing letters, music, even people grooming their children in ways that feel spontaneous and true, as if these are artlessly unconstructed moments captured in time. If you take, for example, Gerard Terborch's Woman Writing a Letter, which he made around 1654, here he very masterfully portrays the quiet moment of a young woman putting her private thoughts to paper. Pictured quill in hand, totally absorbed by her missive, she occupies the space so naturally that it feels as if Terborch has observed this fleeting scene from life. And it's possible that he did, because the woman in the picture is identifiable as his half-sister, Gesina, who was around 22 or 23 at the time that he painted this work. So a scene of Gesina over her letter, the stillness of her very gently sloping form and her fixed gaze broken only by this really actively upright quill and carpet hurriedly pushed aside, this could easily have been one that Terborg stumbled upon in his daily life. But that he chose to portray it and to endow it with the feeling of the momentary is a remarkable departure from earlier genre paintings, such as this one by Esaias van de Velde, which features a very festive communal gathering set in this lavish outdoor space. And although the figures in this image are very lively, they don't feel alive. But Gesina, on the other hand, with this quiet serenity and intense focus, possesses a really deep psychological presence. Adding to the dynamism of the composition is Terborg's remarkable technical ability to reproduce the nubby texture of a wool carpet or the dull glisten of the inkwell, even the soft texture of the quill, which upon close inspection shows that Terborg initially positioned it at a much more relaxed angle, but he later altered it to be more upright and active, so reinforcing the scene's sense of vitality. So what changed? This interest in evoking the immediacy and the humanity of a moment, rather than a whimsical narrative or an imagined locale, dovetails with a series of cultural events and phenomena in the 17th century that had an impact on the rhythm and the regularity of daily life, and really on reflections on transience and mortality. Beginning in the 17th century, for example, there emerged an interest in the composition of histories, memoirs, diaries, autobiographies, and other such compositions that approached time as a linear concept. So prior to the 17th century, time was really perceived cyclically, marked by the return of the day or the season, rather than as this constant progression of time marked by the past, the present, and the future. But during the 17th century, there developed this interest in the idea that time could be regarded linearly as this continual stream, and moreover captured and fixed vis-a-vis these memoirs or diaries or histories and the like. Among these very famous so-called ego documents is the memoir of Konstantin Huygens, who was the Huygens senior, to note, who was the secretary of the Dutch stadtholder Frederick Hendrik, and in 1631, he wrote an autobiography of the first 35 years of his life, so. But there was a lot happening, and he wrote it in Latin, including his introduction to a young Rembrandt. And then there's also the diary of his son, Konstantin Huygens Jr., who also became secretary to the stadtholder, but Prince William of Orange. And he composed a diary from 1688 to 1696. Now, the senior Huygens on the left began writing with his youth, or his writing begins with his youth, and it ends with the birth of his third child. And it recounts stories from his childhood, the trajectory of his education and his profession, as well as observations about his children. Konstantin Jr.'s diary, which was private and never meant to be published, possesses near daily entries. He actually only missed 25 days over the course of 9 years. And they describe everything. They describe the weather, what he did, who he saw, sometimes what he forgot to do. There's this one entry in which he says, "I was getting ready in the morning and I put my hand into my coat pocket and oh, there was a letter I forgot to mail." And you think, yeah, I've been there. There are over 1,500 pages in Konstantin Jr.'s diary, but they always follow a chronological pattern. And they're even labeled sometimes with the time of day that he's writing. Some even specify like the exact hour. So details that, while difficult for us to imagine, were very modern, were in fact just that. And these ego documents, which are a trove of information for scholars of 17th century Dutch culture, they weren't just limited to elite families like the Huygens. There are numerous diaries and autobiographies by otherwise unknown individuals, for example, a schoolmaster from The Hague or a rhetorician from Amsterdam. These are also extant. And like the Huygens documents, they're also structured chronologically, so really reflecting this new interest in temporality vis-a-vis their recordings of like genealogical data, information from the past, personal accomplishments, so things about their present, or even just musings on the future. So this new modern awareness of time as linear and even quantifiable was closely related to developments of new technologies for measuring time. Around 1656, Christian Huygens, Constantine Sr.'s son and Junior's brother, he made a major breakthrough in timekeeping when he invented the first pendulum clock. So Galileo had articulated the principle as early as 1602, but Huygens developed the concept for practical purposes of clockmaking by using the pendulum as a way to regulate the mechanism of movement rather than this old system of pulled weights. So by the end of 1656, the first pendulum clock after his design was produced, which vastly improved the accuracy of clocks, and not the least of which because it enabled the addition of a minute hand and also a second hand. And what I'm showing you here, and you really can't see it, but there's a clock here at the Amsterdam Town Hall, which was completed in 1655. And then once this new system of time was developed, they replaced the clock so that it would have a minute hand, because before that, it was just an hour hand. So time was soft. So as a result, things like transportation systems developed regular schedules that were, quite importantly, accurate. One could travel by horse-drawn barge or a Trek Scout from Amsterdam to Harlem, for example, in 1 hour, or from Harlem to Leiden in 2 hours, with trips leaving every half hour. You could go to Delft, or from Delft to The Hague in 1 hour, with trips leaving every half hour. And the departures were announced by bells ringing, and the barge system had become so dependable that foreigners would routinely marvel at how accurate they were at observing their published schedules, and moreover, that skippers who were late faced really heavy fines. And then, so then later in 1675, Christian Huygens develops the first spiral spring balance, which could be applied to wristwatches. So shifting their focus from mostly decorative to actually keeping time. At the same time that these literary and scientific innovations were reflecting this new experience and expression of time, there was also a series of catastrophic events that may have also inspired meditations on ideas of transience and mortality. So in the summer of 1652, for example, there was a massive fire that destroyed Amsterdam Town Hall. And this was a hugely important structure in civic life. The fire, according to one witness, left behind nothing but rubble and stone. The episode was represented by numerous Dutch artists, including Jan Bergstraten, who recorded the ruined structure the day after the fire in this really beautiful drawing, which he then used to compose several paintings of the event. And I think what you can see is he took certain liberties with his painted composition. He compressed the topography a bit. He tweaked certain angles of nearby buildings. Nevertheless, the painting is so naturalistic, especially in the rendering of the fire's screaming flames or the billowing smoke, or you see this group of people here forming a bucket brigade. He makes us feel that we are witnessing this event. 2 years later, there was a gunpowder magazine in Delft that exploded when between 80 and 90,000 pounds of gunpowder accidentally ignited. The explosion leveled a quarter of the city with a boom that could be heard almost 100 miles away. It ripped trees out of the ground, it blew roofs off houses, it injured more than 1,000 people, and it killed another 200, including one of the city's most famous artists at the time, Karl Fabricius. And news of this event spread very quickly, and the site became sort of a tourist destination with people traveling from all over the country to come and bear witness to this event. And in fact, the area was left untouched for a while so that people could come and wander around the paths around the rubble and the ruin to reflect on this tragedy. And as in Amsterdam, the Delft Thunderclap, as it was called, it quickly found its way into artists' repertoires. Daniel Vosmar, who's the artist on the left, and Egbert van der Poel on the right, who were both natives of the city of Delft, are among several artists that rendered the explosion, which was later chronicled by Dirk van Bleeswijk in his description of the city of Delft. And he recorded that in 1667. So according to van Bleeswijk, the cries of the injured and the desperate were so pitiful that a heart of stone and diamonds would be moved by these sad lamentations. Von Blaeswijk also reported that many who endured the event had believed that the explosion's great thunder actually signaled the end of days and the impending last judgment, when God would bring them all to reckon for how they had lived their lives. So for von Blaeswijk and others, the disaster was a poignant reminder of the fragility of life. And as he wrote, quoting the words of the second epistle of St. Peter the Apostle, "But the day of the Lord shall come as a thief, in which the heavens shall pass away with great violence, and the elements shall be melted with heat, and the earth and the works which are in it shall be burnt up." So the picture is produced by Vosmar, van der Poel, and others. They vividly describe the destruction and despair of this explosion in really similarly apocalyptic terms. And regardless of whether they were produced immediately or years after the fact, they all focus on the now-ness. In Vosmar's depiction on the left, which is actually from the year of the explosion, you see several figures that are standing just sort of like mesmerized by what's happening. You see a child right here running, covering his ears as if they're still ringing with the sound of the blast. And you see a similar temporal specificity in van der Poel's painting on the right, which appears there, you know, men and women fleeing with these frantic expressions. Together, van der Poel and Vosmar reproduced or painted this image more than 20 times, which indicates their fascination with the subject. But it also bespeaks the presence of a really robust art market that not only wanted to commemorate the disaster, but that also really wanted to make it feel present. And I think this feeling of presence, of the now, is not totally dissimilar from what we see in Ter Borch, in this highly naturalistic woman writing a letter. With its focus on the woman's inner life and her emotional character, its extraordinary immediacy, it too conveys the sense of having been transcribed from life. Ter Borch's images had not always possessed this quality. He spent the early part of his career painting portraits, tavern scenes with sometimes drunken soldiers in them. But it was only around 1650 that he really turned to images like this, or this beautiful work from the Rijksmuseum, in which he pictures this strikingly personal moment between a woman and her maid. The woman, who is again identifiable as Gesina, is clearly of high standing with this crisp, shimmering satin dress and her elaborate coif. But she sits with her back to us, which is a masterful compositional device that underscores the privacy of the moment unfolding and our privileged access to it. Ter Borch emphasizes this sentiment by allowing us to see the woman through the reflection in the mirror held by the page. She's totally unaware of our presence, which means she's totally unguarded. And although there are no details to illuminate the circumstances of the encounter, the interaction between these three figures, one of whom is a known person, is so psychologically pregnant that it evokes the feeling of a true moment captured in time. According to Dutch art theory, the ability to create such a compelling visual fiction to make something feel true signified the highest artistic achievement. Beginning in the early 17th century with the theorist Carl van Maander, who in 1604 published a manual for painters called Het Schilderboek, the painting book, artists were encouraged to draw from the visible world, from life, as well as from the intellect, the imagination, to create as realistic a scene as possible. Now, although van Maander believed that the noblest application of these elements would be in the service of history painting, which is to say scenes from classical antiquity, history, scripture, the emphasis on clearly observing nature from life was underscored by numerous theorists after him, and important among them was Philip Engel, who in 1641, he delivered a speech to the Leiden Painters Guild, during which he exalted the virtues of painting and expressed in no uncertain terms that the primary concern of a painter was to conquer and capture the eyes of art lovers through the creation of semblance without being. And he published this 1 year later under the title Lofter Schilderkunst, which is in praise of the art of painting. And he went on to describe the abilities and skills required of a painter who strives to make a painting seem a living reality, semblance without being. In particular, he stressed the need to observe and be able to reproduce that which is found in nature. For example, an artist must be able to combine things in a fluent and natural way. meticulously observe and organize light and shadow, skillfully render texture and reflection in the most pleasing way for all eyes, and above all, leave no trace of his own manner. So, in fact, according to Engel, the highest praise a painter could achieve was when his painting approaches real life without being able to detect in it the manner of the master who made it. A painter able to realize all of this criteria would not only delight the eyes of art lovers, thereby allowing him to sell more paintings, which was key, but he would also secure the highest honor and fame, immortality. Through our art, Engel wrote, we shall wrest ourselves from the voracity of mortality and triumph in spite of death, the strangler of all things, and shall flourish from one century to the next without withering. Unlike Van Maander, Engel did not tie this pursuit to history painting, but instead believed that a skillfully executed genre painting could be just as noble as a work from history. In fact, for Engel, the ultimate example of artistic accomplishment was Terborch's contemporary and fellow genre painter, Gerrit Dou, thanks to his extraordinary naturalness and imitative virtuosity. So as in his Lady at the at her toilet, which you see here, he could masterfully blend his understanding of human nature with an exquisitely refined brush. In this image, we see an alluring young woman and her maid in the final stages of preparing the mistress for a visitor, presumably male, given this big wine cooler in the lower right foreground. And as they pin and prep the last details of her very stylish coiffure, the woman turns her attention away from her own reflection towards something in the mirror. The subtlety of this look, which is really just a glance, combined with her posture and the slight tilt of her head as she gazes out, very cleverly suggests that whatever has caught her eye has only done so in this very moment. And quite wonderfully, what has caught her eye is us. Much like we saw in Terborch's work, Dou suggests that we have happened upon this private experience. Unlike in Terborch's paintings, however, our presence has not gone undetected, which adds an element of excitement and liveliness to the scene. This feeling would have been even more heightened in the painting's original context. Dou originally conceived the painting to be placed behind little doors, and so you open them in this case, you would be confronted by this scene and by this most engaging woman who is not at all displeased by the intrusion. The extraordinary liveliness of the painting, the qualities that earned Dou Engel's great devotion, is due not only to the scene he selected, but also to his technical handling of it. A master fine-skilder or fine painting, it was a technique that was marked by smooth execution, invisible brushwork, and extraordinary attention to detail. He exactingly rendered the woman's satin skirt, the wool tapestry, the pewter jug, with such crisp meticulousness that they convey reality, even though they are just pigments on a support, their semblance without being. Engel's address was just one of numerous eulogizing books and laudatory poems that proclaimed artists' everlasting honor and glory. Van Maander's painting book was not only a manual for painters, but also a compilation of biographies of Dutch and Flemish artists that eulogized artists living and dead. The historian Jan Orlers also celebrated those excellent painters worthy of being written about and chronicled in all the books of eulogy in 1614. And when von Bleiswijk wrote his description of Delft in 1667, the text that recounted the gunpowder explosion, he also stated that although he had elected not to discuss the lives and works of living artists, he had hoped that after these artists had passed away, when death had snatched their artful brush from their hands, they will earn even more praise and immortality in the books of memory of famous artists by some other eloquent pen. The personal experience of time was thus undergoing a dramatic change. For Dou, Terborch, and their peers, this shift may have been even more pronounced as histories, treaties, and encomia praising the timelessness of their art and profession appeared in publication, perhaps not only encouraging them to express this newfound awareness of time and temporality within their art, but emboldening them to consider their own sense of mortality or even immortality. Of course, it is very difficult to determine with any certainty the degree to which scientific inventions or ego documents and broader cultural phenomena influenced artists. Nevertheless, the relationship between paintings such as Terborg's Woman at the Mirror, Dow's Lady at Her Toilet, and the growing interest in time and temporality highlights a connection. And indeed, as we look to the work of their contemporaries, we see this connection as a common thread. The fleetingness of time pervades the work of Gabriel Metsu and Franz von Mieris. In Metsu's Woman Writing a Letter, which pictures this woman looking out at the viewer, her quill is hovering ever so gracefully above the silver inkwell, as if we had interrupted her mid-action. He further convinces us of its naturalism through the woman herself, who has very distinctive features. So it suggests that she's a real living person, and it has been suggested that maybe it's even a portrait, rather than just a figure conjured from the imagination. Even the spaniel that's poised alertly beside her conveys the now-ness of this moment. Von Mieris, on the other hand, reflected notions of temporality in his version of the same subject by situating the letter writer in this nocturnal setting. The momentary quality of the image is evident not only by the temporary darkness of night, but also in the flickering flame of the candle, itself ephemeral and transient. Adding to the dynamism of the work is this woman's focused expression, which is a real indication of her active mind. Of course, his extraordinary handling of paint, again, in particular, his rendering of this lush velvet coat with its really soft fur trim, whose verisimilitude just sort of begged to be touched. Of course, there is no discussion of 17th century Dutch genre painting complete without Vermeer. And I say this sort of joking, but it's true. He was, after all, an artist of his time, as the show Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting so beautifully illustrates. However, Vermeer's relationship to time is very different. And here I lean on the extensive research of my colleague, Arthur Wheelock, who has spent a lifetime studying this fascinating artist and who has articulated those qualities that we all find so compelling about his art in a word that I find very fascinating, which is timeless. As Arthur has noted, Vermeer's paintings possess a feeling of permanence, of solidity, timelessness that distinguished his paintings from those of his peers. The stability of his figures, the subtlety of his light, the limited narrative details, the relative simplicity of the spaces. They have endowed his paintings with a weightiness or a gravitas that makes them feel stable, enduring, timeless. I do want to talk briefly about this quality vis-a-vis the changing relationship with and awareness of time in the 17th century. So as I've discussed, artists Terborg, Dow, Metsu, Van Mieris are conveying time through the momentary qualities of their scenes, the imitative virtuosity of their brushwork, even by including known people in their compositions. Vermeer, on the other hand, for the most part, is not. As in this enchanting work from the Rijksmuseum, which pictures a young woman in a light blue house coat reading a letter in the corner of a room, there is a sense of absolute quietude that pervades this scene. And here the only imaginable sound is like the crinkling of the paper under her fingers. She's standing in profile against a wall decorated by a map of the Netherlands, her arms drawn tightly and her eyes downcast. She is absolutely motionless because she is so fully engrossed in this letter. And as Vermeer so often does, though he seems to be giving us special access to this moment, he also depicted her in such a manner that we won't ever really know her thoughts. The foreground table and chair create this physical barrier. And her expression really reveals nothing of her emotional state. So for us, her narrative really remains a mystery. Utterly quiet, immobile, with no discernible story, the woman feels outside of time. And he enhances this sensation through this masterful rendering of light. Here he illuminates the room with two unseen light sources, which cause the chair behind the table to cast a double shadow. But this light completely fails to affect the woman at all, who casts no shadow. And to underscore just how different Vermeer's relationship to time is from that of his contemporaries, we can look at his image of a lace maker from 1662 compared to those by Nicholas Moss and Caspar Netscher, the Maas, which is from 1656, and the Netscher, which is from the same time as the Vermeer. Clearly, Vermeer is not the first to paint a lace maker. Yet compared to Maas, and this painting is actually one of the earliest of this subject, and compared to Netscher, we see the singularity of his approach. Maas pictured a woman seated in the back of a dim room, bent over her sewing, a baby holding a pacifier and a ball propped up in the chair beside her, and the accoutrements of daily life surround them, a ceramic porringer, a silver cup and a rattle, perhaps discarded in the midst of a tantrum, but if you have kids, you know, they just throw things. And this really just underscores the domesticity of the scene. Like Maas, Netscher also depicted a woman in the center of the room, fully engrossed in the activity of lace making. She's removed her shoes, and her broom is sort of resting neatly nearby, again, emblems of domesticity that perhaps indicate the end of the day's work. For both these artists, the suggestion of a narrative and a location are of the utmost importance. Netscher's articulation of the pine board floors or the shells, even the landscape print tacked to the wall, they reveal this extraordinary sensitivity to time and place. Vermeer, on the other hand, offers no such specificity. Like Maas and Netscher, he portrayed a woman making lace, but there the similarities end. He eliminated nearly all accessories except for the book on the table to capture the lace maker's deep concentration in her work. Placed against a bare white wall with the action pushed so close to the foreground that we don't see the ceiling, the floor, the windows, or any other objects in the room, Vermeer has removed any information that would narratively and temporally locate this moment. And unlike his colleagues who took great care in rendering the minutiae of their scene surroundings, the cracks in the floorboard, the creases in the print, Vermeer is not only unconcerned with imitating these details in this exacting way, in some places he abstracts them. Notice the red and white dribbles of paint that come out of this cushion, like a colorful waterfall. These are forms with no basis in reality. So in many ways, Vermeer's lace maker embodies the newfound awareness of time in art through its apparent rejection of it, bucking the trend to suggest temporality through believable narratives or virtuosically rendered textures. Vermeer stops time through this compositional, stylistic, and technical choices. Remarkably, these qualities that forsake all of Engel's recommendations, especially his belief that a painter's hand should never be should be detectable in his work, but he accomplishes Engel's ultimate goal nevertheless, minimizing movement, reducing figural representation, denying proximity in space, suspending narrative clues, and calling attention to the tools of his trade, to the paint. He collapsed time, which quite wonderfully ends up encouraging us to spend more time lingering over, reflecting on, and delighting in his art. According to Engel, by capturing all that is transient, the artist defies nature and time, but by engaging the viewer over and over, capturing his eyes, and forcing him to spend time with art, the artist triumphs over death. For, as Engel exclaimed in his conclusion, through art, the painter wrests himself from mortality as paintings can survive several hundred years, and that is enough. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.